Well, good morning, everybody. We have another chance to dig into the text of Judges, our descent into the quagmire that is the spiritual malaise of the people of God in Canaan as they make their inevitable spiral deeper and deeper into the mess that they have created. Jared, how are you doing this morning?
I am doing great. I am 99% free from the kind of enslavement of grading. I've just got one more thing to fix, and I'm done with school for the semester, which feels really good. And, you know, it's time to start working on fall.
Excellent. I'm sure the summer break will be a nice, pleasant boon, even though it's a little weird or a lot weird, depending on the day, it seems like.
A lot less traveling, I think, than we'd originally planned on.
I think so. That's probably the same for all of us. So a couple of things before we get too much more into the class for this morning. In a moment, I'm going to lead us in prayer. Jared's going to be reading for chapter 13 of the text of Judges. There's a lot that's in there. We've got an attempt on the schedule, at least, to cover chapter 13 and chapter 14 this morning as
we
look at
it.
Samson. Let's settle in for that in just a second. We'll introduce the text, and Jared will probably start reading around verse 2 of chapter 13. But let's go to God in prayer to start off our study today. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to approach your throne of grace and mercy. We hope that you are gracious to us. We hope that it will allow us the time to develop strong faith, the wisdom to apply it, and the opportunity to exercise it. Please give us strength of conviction and contentment in a time of confusion. Allow us to learn deeply from the servants of yours who have walked before us, to learn from both their successes and their failures in a way that magnifies you. This is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen.
Amen.
So the text here is kind of going to include at least two important things to think about before we actually explain some of the details. One is that you'll probably recognize, and I believe that the initial recipients of the message should have recognized as well, is that this is a special birth story. It's similar to the birth stories we've already seen. It's also certainly going to reflect future birth stories that we'll see as God unfolds his grand plan. This is showing that Samson, whose name is special in some couple ways, is a child of promise. And so that birth narrative is really the backdrop for the rest of the story. And so right now, Jared's going to open up the text for us. And Jared, I think you're going to read, what, verses 2 through maybe even the end of the chapter?
Yep, that's what we're going to do. So it's a little bit longer reading, so I'd encourage you to kind of stick with it. But I think it's useful to have the whole thing in our mind as we get started.
And here we go.
Now there was a certain man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren. She had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have borne no children, but you will conceive and bear a son. So be careful and drink no wine or strong drink, eat nothing unclean, because you will conceive and bear a son, and no razor will come upon his head, for the child will be a Nazarite dedicated to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." Then the woman came to her husband. "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very awesome. I didn't ask where he was from, and he didn't tell me his name, but he said, 'Behold, you will conceive and bear a son, so drink no wine or strong drink, eat nothing unclean, for the child should be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.' Then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, please let this man of God whom you sent come again to us and teach us what we're to do with the child who's to be born.' And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, 'Behold, the man who came to me the other day has appeared to me.' And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said, 'Are you the man who spoke to this woman?' And he said, 'I am.' And Manoah said, 'Now when your words come true, what is to be the child's manner of life, and what is his mission?' And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, 'Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not drink of anything that comes from the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink or any unclean thing. All that I commanded, let her observe. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you, prepare young goat for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, if you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, so that when your words come true, we may honor you? And the angel of the Lord said to them, why do you ask my name, seeing that it's wonderful? So Manoah took the young goat from the grain offering and offered it on the rock to the Lord, to the one who works wonders. And Manoah and his wife were watching. And when the flame went up towards the heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord went up in flame, the flame of the altar. Now Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell on their faces to the ground. And the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife. And then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, we will surely die because we've seen God. And his wife said to him, if the Lord meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering in our hands, or shown us these things, or now announced us such things as these. And the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the young man grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Machanadan between Zorah and Eshtaol.
All right, so that's a good chunk of 24, 25 verses. But there's at least three important things in this narrative that we can draw attention to that set the stage for the rest of our understanding of who Samson is, what God is going to accomplish with him, and what we need to see. So what would be like the first big thing that you would want to call attention to for us, Jared?
I mean, the first thing is what you've already alluded to a little bit, is this guy, this Samson, this is, you know, this is a birth announcement. And what I mean by that is, if you think about the most famous children, right, in the Bible, I mean, you get people like Isaac or Jacob or Samuel or John the Baptist or Jesus. And you know what's similar about all those guys? This is what's similar. I mean, you get an angel who shows up and it's like, hey, you're barren, but you're going to have a kid. You know, anytime you're reading in the scriptures and you see a woman's barren, you know, actually she's about to have a kid, right? Like, that's why it's introduced, to emphasize that this is God's, you know, miraculous providence for the people. And whenever this happens, they've got a special destiny. You know, angels visit Sarah, the Lord grants Isaac's prayer for Rebecca, you know, Eli grants Hannah's request, all those sorts of things. And they're going to be given a special name. And all of these people are supposed to be saviors of a sort. And here we have this guy, Samson. And here, even if we don't know, you know, we're reading the story for the first time, we can tell that this is kind of the climax of the story, that here this guy's an Isaac after the failed Abraham of Jephthah. Here we've finally gotten a person who's from Dan, and we knew that as all the judges have marched north, that Dan's kind of the climax of that whole thing. And we think, oh man, this guy, this judge, he is going to be awesome.
Yeah, I think there's like two other things. We got, you know, that his background is really important. I think we noticed already from the birth, and we want to make a note of this. He was supposed to be a Nazirite, and so we're going to make a good note of that. Well, in a second, we'll talk about his name. You know, there's some meaning to that might be of value for us. But also where he's at, his nation, you know, where he's positioned, how that fits into the broader picture of where Israel is and will be. I wanted to also note this. We had already been introduced to the Philistines earlier in the text of Judges. Samson becomes a key participant in the conflict between Israel and the Philistine people. And we talked about this before the study. The Philistines are an Aegean people. I think we came up with being Greek adjacent as the best illustration of that. So if you're familiar with Greek history, Greek narratives, Greek processes, everything is going to be kind of similar. Even as almost everyone notes, Samson feels a lot like Hercules. I think there's some importance to catch there as well. So what else is necessary for us to pay attention to? We'll talk about his name in a second, in his nationality. Like, what's his family background? What's kind of going on that with that spiritually, some history, some culture that will help us see why Samson is the way that he is?
Well, one thing you see already that this is kind of functions in the thing that we've seen in Judges, where these kind of degradation of the family unit, is that look at what we've seen this relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Manoah, right? That, you know, we've seen a lot of these sorts of things in Judges. Well, you know, who does he appear to? The angel keeps on appearing to the woman. It doesn't appear until the last to the husband. That he gets a name, but she doesn't. That again, he keeps trying to get the angel to show up to him, but he doesn't even believe or recognize that it's an angel when he does show up to him. You know, I don't know what he thinks he is, this, you know, random guy coming and giving him a prophecy or whatever else. But when he finally does realize, he thinks God's going to kill him. And his wife's like, are you an idiot? Like, he would have done this beforehand. And this is, again, kind of a flip of Abraham and Sarah, where Abraham gets the angels who come and announce, and Sarah's the one who doesn't believe, right? She's the one who laughs. But here it's the opposite. It's a lot more like Deborah and Barak, where the woman is the one who really seems to have the faith and not the man. And here we have from his beginning of his life, and what we're going to see to the death, is that Samson's life is going to be dominated by women. His mother, his first wife, a prostitute, Delilah. All of these things are going to influence what's going on in his life.
Yeah, I'll add this too. I think I want to make this point as precise as I can. A lot of times we hear people who have just started reading the Old Testament, or maybe they're introducing themselves to the broader work of God, and they come away with a patriarchal view of the story, that it's all about dudes or men. And a careful reading of the Old Testament from Genesis all the way to John through Revelation shows a much more holistic interaction between men and women, sometimes to even a higher degree than all the contemporary nations of that era, that God's message includes a deeper interaction between the male and female parts of creation than anything else, at least that I'm aware of from my survey of ancient Near Eastern culture and the texts that they would leave for us. And so I think that's important to catch, because in Judges, you find more good women than bad as participants in the stories in a survey level. You know, obviously you have to value judge all the other things in the context of their immediate settings. Mr. and Mrs. Manoah certainly have, that dichotomy going early on. As to how it plays out, it's a different thing. So with Samson's name, do you catch the literary connection to more than Jehovah in his name? I know I do. I don't know if you do as well.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things, and this is going to be even more explicit by the time we get to the end of the story, is his name, in Hebrew, Shimshon. There's no actual, even in English, there's no P in there, even though we always say Samson. Mm-hmm. It means kind of something like sun boy. And this is going to be really important, because he's almost fated to go against Delilah, because Delilah is related to the Hebrew word Lila, which means night. And so these two people are going to be day and night, diametrically opposed. And even in their names, we're seeing that's where we're going in this situation. But this question of what happens with sundown and nighttime and sunrise is going to be really crucial to Samson's narrative, especially when we get into chapter 15 and beyond.
Yeah, and early on, this family seems rightfully suited to raise a righteous child, from all that we can tell. They're praying, they're reaching out, they're asking for God to hear them, to listen to them, to respond to them. Here's a little foreshadowing for my sermon here shortly, the Shema Yisrael, or Shema of God. So you're seeing them do that, where they're trying to accomplish those goals. And yet, not exactly.
Not exactly.
So that brings us into chapter 14, which really is, this is what you were providentially given. God gave them something pretty cool. And then we get to chapter 14, verse 1. And I'm going to go ahead and read for us, I think, verses chapter 14, verses 1 through 9 right now. Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." But his father and mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people? You must go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine." I think that's the first time we see that phrase.
It is.
"But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes.' His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, a young lion came toward him roaring, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. After some days, he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. Behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. He scraped it out with his hands and went on eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion." All right. So, in that text right there, there is a lot of both, "Wait a minute, that's not what I expected this Samson to be." And then, "Wait a minute, what is he doing?"
And a whole lot of, "Wait a minute, we're in Judges, this is exactly what I expected it to be." It's kind of this, you know, backwards and forwards situation going on there.
Yeah. Not the Samson that we wanted, but perhaps the Samson that God used is another way.
Yeah, absolutely so. Absolutely so.
So in verses 1 through 4, in the first part of the text here, there's a couple of things that I think are important. And by the way, we didn't make a specific mention of it, but verse 1, chapter 13, Israel has a gun engaged in what is evil in the sight of the Lord. I mean, that's where they begin the narrative of Samson, which I think is, for us, maybe the 10th official judge we didn't pay attention to. But in the end of chapter 12, we've got three other ones. We'll just quickly make note of that kind of fill out the space from Jephthah to Samson. And so that brings us to this. So now we've got this Samson that we don't even really want him doing this, and yet he does. So what's important here in verses 1 through, say, 4, for us to note in regards to where Samson is in the story, what God's teaching us, and what do we need to know?
Yeah, I think there's really two things here. I mean, the first one, for those of y'all who don't know, I was raised Jewish, and my bubby is a standard New York Jew, and, you know, it's kind of this typical Jewish discussion, you know, "Well, why can't you marry a nice Jewish girl?" You know, like, here we have this whole discussion. He's like, you know, "The world's your oyster, and you have to marry this, you know, this goy over here." And that is what is the face, that he's got kind of all these Israelites that he could choose, but he doesn't want that. He wants a Philistine. You know, she's different. She's exotic. She's one of these other nations. And something that's going to be crucial, absolutely crucial for Samson's story, is he sees that she is right in his eyes. Samson's a person who is driven by what he sees. His eyes are going to lead him all over the place. Pay attention to that as you read through the story. But there's something else going on here. This term "right in his eyes," the Hebrew term is yashar, and it generally means morally upright. But here, it just means he thinks she's hot, right? Like, this is, you know, kind of like Jacob, right? Because Jacob also is someone who comes from a barren situation. But Jacob, you know, doesn't see Leah, who's morally good. He sees Rachel because, you know, she was a beautiful face and form, or as I have my Hebrew 1 students translate, a hottie with a body. And that's what he wants. And that's what Samson wants over and over and over again, is just whatever his eyes desire. He's just like Adam and Eve, that they see that the apple is good and they take it.
Right, and this is also the kind of the introduction to two great practical truths. We're about to see what is the big fat Philistine wedding scene. You're going to see that Greek adjacent story play out, and there's a lot of Greco-Roman, early Greco stuff that becomes part of the Roman culture as well in this marital give and take. But beginning in the text here is a great point that says it really does matter who you marry and who you don't. I think those are two great truths that we often, like you pointed out with your own background, we apply strange values to that process rather than looking at the bigger plan of God and how important that is. And I'm just going to make a side note from a perspective of age. I can tell you from my anecdotal experience, every single time a person married another individual who was not on the same path spiritually, it was bad for both of them. And by bad, I don't mean they both fell away from whatever heritage they had. I said it was incredibly conflict-ridden. Even if they reconciled and moved into a healthy spiritual position, it was conflict-ridden because they were on two different pathways. Samson's pathway is definitely downward. And so he's going to pull everybody else with him. But he never picks a good one to begin with.
Yeah, and you bring up downward, and that is actually something that we see literarily a lot in Samson's narrative, is that he goes down to Timnah. And whenever he goes down to Timnah, it's towards the Philistines and towards idolatry. And when he comes back up to Dan, we see that there's this up-down sort of backwards and forwards. And it doesn't just end up bad for Samson. We're going to see it ends up pretty terribly for this girl as well. So those are those things. One thing that Terry brought up is he said, hey, we've already broken a Nazirite vow situation. We've said he was a Nazirite. What do we mean by Nazirite vow? What things are required by the Nazirite vows?
Well, you think about this. In the text itself, going back to the introduction of the Nazirite vow context, I'll make two quick side points. We're not quite sure what the judges themselves know. I'm not sure that they fully explore that in the text. So to whether they know they were Nazirites or they didn't know they were Nazirites is a side issue.
But in this case, at least, we do know he knows because the angel has told his parents.
Right. The angels tell his parents, but the bigger picture, like even the people reading the story.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure what they knew. Because this is a learning story. So we're going to begin, at least in this text of chapter 14, see actually two components of the vows broke off. One of this is a prohibition against touching a corpse. And you'll notice he shares the sin with his family and does so without telling them what he did. That to me indicates, based on a parental level, I've lived long on the earth, and my own stupid behavior level, he knew what he was doing.
I mean, this connects again to the garden, just again for Terry, is that, right, this is like the woman who takes the apple and shares it with her husband. But here, where Adam knows exactly what's going on, here his parents are unwittingly made unclean by this corpse honey.
Yeah. And so just for things to look for, certainly number six, no great products. You know, the hair, the classic one will come up, and then touching corpses, which we've already seen. I think we also talked about this beforehand. It's different with Samson, too, that the Nazirite vow of Numbers is supposed to be short-lived. There's a time constraint on it. The Nazirite vow of Samson is lifelong. It's supposed to be his whole life. That brings us into the big fat Philistine wedding narrative. And Jared, do you want to go ahead and read the rest of this for us? This is starting in verse 10 and actually just walk us through the rest of the chapter.
His father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there, for so the young men used to do. And as soon as the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. And Samson said to them, let me now put a riddle to you. If you can tell me what it is, within the 7 days of this feast, find it out. Then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot tell me what it is, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, put us the riddle before us so we can hear it. So he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat. out of the strong came something sweet. And in 3 days, they still couldn't solve the riddle. But on the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband and get him to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here to impoverish us? And Samson's wife wept over him and said, you only hate me, you don't love me, and you have put a riddle to my people and you haven't told me what it is. And he said to her, behold, I haven't told my own father and my mother. Should I tell you? And she wept before him the 7 days that the feast lasted. And on the seventh day he told her because she pressed him hard. And then he told the riddle to her people. And the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, if you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have found out my riddle. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon, and he struck down 30 men of the town, and he took their spoil, and he gave their garments to those who had told him the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to his companion, the one who had been his best man.
So there's a couple of things that are going to be super obvious as we walk back through this text, but I wanted to bring up the funnel and ring structure again, just to tie together to Othniel chapter 3, verses 7 and following. One of the things that I think is important to see really quickly is the connection between those two stories. This marital introduction has some great contrast. Othniel marries an insider, someone who is really kind of connected into the spiritual story of Israel. Samson goes outside. There is both intentionality with some of these choices in God's part, but I will say not so much on Samson's part.
No.
God is moving the lever that is Samson to move forward the arc of Israel towards its safe resting place in Jesus. That's kind of the pushing it forward on the blocks side of things.
Yeah, I mean, Othniel's an Edomite who wants to become an Israelite, and Samson's an Israelite who wants to become a Philistine. And mm-hmm. Othniel brings 40 years of peace, and Samson, 40 years of oppression. I mean, they're diametrically opposed.
Right. Almost as much as the day and the night can be. So what else are we going to kind of pay attention to here in the big, fat Philistine wedding? There's some wedding stuff here. I want to talk about his riddle, if you will. It's not really a riddle. It's more of a child's game he's playing with the Philistines. But what do we need to pay attention to right here?
So, you know, as you've said, these guys, these Philistines, they're Greek adjacent. They are Hellenic or Aegean peoples. They're the Peleshet in Egyptian records. These are kind of Greek mercenaries who fought for the Egyptians. And then, you know, God says in Amos, that God's brought them into Israel, brought them into Palestine, just as he's brought Israel there. And so this wedding, this is a Philistine wedding. And the word actually used here is not just, you know, a party, but it's, I guess we would call it a drinking party. In other words, strike two for Samson. There are definitely wine products all over the place. But we also see that he has to be given these companions. This is the Greek hetairoi. This is not an Israelite thing. You don't read about this in any of the other weddings. And you have a customary kind of questions and answers, riddles sort of a period. And that's what he does. And he makes a bet, right? 31 odds of clothing, and clothing super, super expensive, super, super important. You see that throughout the biblical story. And how that plays out. And notice, when does he find out, or when do these people bring the answer to his riddle?
Yeah. I'll add this. He's basically playing the Michael Jordan downfall thing, where he's digging into gambling for those who have been watching the game. A little side pop culture reference for you. But
Cincinnati, it's Pete Rose, right?
So. Right. And it tarnishes, again, his story. Because all of this kind of inches towards an understanding of Samson being different than what we expected him to be and what we wanted him to be, even though we know that this is Judges and it's awful. And all of that gradually unfolds before our eyes. So there's some other things that come out of this. I want to add that the riddle he chooses has a very obvious solution, and the solution is him. Even though it has some specifics he's looking for, because basically the riddle is about Samson too. It's not really a riddle. It's a I win, I win, I win, because nobody should be able to know the answer to this. It's that level of obscurity. Like, you either have to be inspired and have been there, you know, or not, in the sense of the way that it's not really a riddle in the sense we think about riddles either. That's kind of an ambiguous translation in my understanding. It's not reasonable. You can't reason your way out of this anyway.
Yeah, it's like the final riddle that Bilbo asks Smeagol in The Hobbit. You know, what's in my pocket?
Yeah.
You know, not really something you can answer.
Exactly. So we have a quick question. I want to make sure I read it real fast. This may have already been mentioned. I missed it. But regarding the judges cycle in chapter 13, it seems to me we're missing a key component. The people are oppressed, but they do not cry out. Caleb's exactly right. We don't see a written literary note about that. That's why in the subpoint to this, grace doesn't always look like we think it should or does. God is gracious to Israel. He's still bringing them out of this, but they're not asking as a group, as a people. We do see Mr. and Mrs. Manoah engaging in a level of direct interaction with God and his people. We also see Samson do that to a different degree in his story, which is interesting because Jephthah definitely gives a Canaanite offering to Jehovah, as far as I can see in the text. Samson, we're like, there's a little bit more looseness with Samson's behavior than we saw with Jephthah in that contrast.
Well, and it's also interesting because with Jephthah, we don't see God raising up a judge. And yet here with Samson, God has raised Samson up from before he was born.
Yeah.
I mean, that's – talk about a contrast.
One more tidbit for those who are keeping track. This is, I think, the fourth iteration of a judge being empowered by Jehovah and his designs. The Spirit of the Lord is specifically referenced for Samson here. It's a great thing to recognize because Samson's moral character is never really in question as an adult. He doesn't have much. You know, where others, we can kind of make a key, like maybe here and there. But it helps us answer the question is that can God and will God use the unrighteous to judge the righteous? And will God use the unrighteous to judge the unrighteous? And the answer is yes. And it's just as surprising to us as it was to the people in the lifetimes of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on. We have that same reaction. We don't want it to be that way. We want to hear your hero to come as a savior. And God doesn't always work in the ways that we want. And Jesus then subverts all of our expectations and is a king and a hero, but by no means the kind of king and hero that Israel expected or we expected. All right, so back into the text. We kind of segued off of that a little bit, but that's part of the plan as well. This brings us to around verse 15. You already kind of foreshadowed this a little bit, where they basically try to weasel the answer out of his wife. And we see a little bit more about the character of the woman whom Samson was enthralled with.
Yeah, and it's not even just weaseling, right? They're threatening her. They're like, look, we are going to burn you and your house with fire, right? I mean, here, this is another Jephthah's daughter, right? The person who's going to pay is not the guilty party. It's not Samson, right? Mm-hmm. It's not Jephthah. It's the woman who's closest to the guilty party. Because that's what we've seen. You know, you brought up earlier about this kind of patriarchal society. Although the Bible is not what we kind of, when we hear that bad context of patriarchal, the time in which it's written absolutely is. And we see in Judges that going off the rails. If you've ever heard the term, you know, toxic masculinity, you know, people like, oh, is that a biblical term? I said, read the book of Judges. You see it there all the time, right? Of course, if you read the book of Kings, you get toxic femininity, but that's a whole other story. But here they're threatening her. They're like, we're going to kill you. And everybody you know, if you don't get us this answer.
Yeah, and regardless of the person, male or female, if the gang that's threatening you gets large enough, the risk becomes unmanageable. You know, a big guy, one, two people, he probably won't feel afraid. 5 or 10 people, There's nothing you could do at that point.
No. And these are all 30 of the companions, right? I mean, here's your gang.
Yeah. Gangland, Genesis to Revelation. It's pretty much just gangs all over the place. So in seeing this now in the text, she then doesn't tell him what's going on. In the way the text is rendering, she and then manipulates Samson for the answer rather than going to her betrothed slash spouse in this nebulous transition of marital states and says, hey, this is what happened. Would that change the story? Absolutely. Just like any other individual choice changes the story. And yet that's not what she does.
Yeah. And what we have with both of them is, just again to pick on Terry with garden stuff, a refusal to understand God's purpose for marriage, right? What does God say in Genesis? But you're supposed to leave your father and mother's house and cleave to your spouse. And mm-hmm. here she's still worried about her father's and mother's house. And he says, look, I haven't even told my parents. Why would I tell you? You know, in other words, there's a very strong distinction between they're still caring more about their family of origin than they are about each other. And that's something we're going to see just again and again and again.
Yeah, it's going to continue to reappear in this process. And he notes he didn't tell anybody about this when it comes to Pat. He didn't even tell his parents.
Nope.
And note, the thing that he doesn't tell his parents is the very thing that would condemn him and them because of the nature of the vow and the broader context of being an Israelite. Wait a minute, you wouldn't touch with a corpse? I mean, there's this whole big picture place. And then now you've defiled us. If you remember the story of Israel coming out of Egypt, that's a big deal. And so he's already hiding things from his parents, which is a fairly consistent practice for Samson as it goes forward. I think verse 18 is important. It foreshadows a little bit, but it also tells us a couple of additional important things. As the table turns, you know, from the sun going up, sun going down, sun boy, Delilah, all of that. And now they give them, Samson and Timnah, the woman from Timnah, the answer. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Basically, the answer is Samson, subtext.
But here we have right at the end, right? Samson just can't keep it together for the last moment, right? It's on the seventh day. He finally caves at the very last second.
Yeah.
And it's right where, again, the sun goes down. His powers as sun boy, you know, if we want to kind of emphasize this, are kind of at their weakest. Just one little cool little linguistic note is that the term there as the sun goes down is a Greek term. It's related to the Greek term helios. It's not the typical Hebrew term that's based on Samson's name for Shemesh, kind of a neat little the Greek aspects of his life eclipsing the Israelite versions of his life in that sort of a way. But he caves.
Yeah.
Right? The folds at the very last bit of game time. Of course, you in Atlanta would know about that, blowing some pretty strong leads, right?
So, well, if I was a strong sportser, I would care. I do know, but they don't influence me in the way of some of my friends are somewhere deeply ingrained into Atlanta sports rise and fall. I thought it was really interesting for me at this point in verses 19 through 20, and I want to specifically emphasize a couple of things here. I'm going to reread verses 19 and 20 again. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. If you're familiar with the stories that will come, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles, who does that sound like?
Sounds like David.
Yeah, it's just straight up David Saul chaos, with both of them, both David and Saul serving in the second layers of this story coming up, because a lot of Saul's behavior is through wrath and rebellion and anger. And a lot of David's behavior matches this. You know, he's supposed to marry one. Oh, no. Here you go. It's going to go to somebody else. He rushes out and gets his gang, his worthless men, his layabouts that he builds an army around himself when he goes to find his prize sword down in the paths of his prior history. So I think there's some foreshadowing for sure that has to be unboxed in what the inspired work of God is trying to teach us about what's going to happen for Israel next. I think Samson really is a lot of that, because we've already pointed out, I think he's, the 10th specifically named judge in the text of Judges. He concludes, in some ways, the bigger narrative block of those judges. And yet, if you're reading this the first time, you don't necessarily know that that's next, because this is your first time reading it. If you're hearing it on the bank of the river, like we've kind of described the text, you may not know what else the storyteller is going to tell you about Israel next. And you may assume that this is as bad as it's going to get. It is not as bad as it's going to get, as a side note. So we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here. What do we want to emphasize as parting comments before we close the door on the first part of Samson's life?
I think one of the most important things to see in this section of Judges, but we've kind of seen it before throughout, is that how God is working behind the scenes of events. Samson does everything that is right in his own eyes. But we read in chapter 14, verse 4, no, it's really God who's in control of all this. Samson thinks he's the master of his own destiny, and to some degree he is. The reason Samson doesn't do more than he does is because he only does what is right in his own eyes. But God is using all of these people. He's using Jephthah, he's using Samson, he's using Gideon, he's using Ehud, he's even using, you know, Abimelech, right? All these people, all these are tools in his hand, tools in his toolbox. And he is bringing about the salvation of Israel and not just of one person.
Yeah, and I think I know that you've all, you know, I also talk about this as well. Another way to think through this is to think about the Spirit of the Lord connections between all of this. Ehud, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, and then we see in the future tense, just like Samuel and David, prior to their roles as either the big prophet or the big king, the Spirit of the Lord moves through them too. I think there's some connections there. I think as a last kind of parting kind of, here's some things. Again, I want to nail down the value of your compatriots with the contrast between Othniel and Samson. Your deep desire then becomes manifested by the people you choose to surround yourself with. Paul uses the phraseology, evil companions corrupt good morals, and we know that to be true. The corollary is equally true. If you seek out good companions, you will inevitably be enriched by that. And Samson's story on a light level has that truth being shown to us. Had he chosen a path that matched his potential, he would have been so, so much more. Again, thanks everybody for being part of our study today. We're so glad that you were able to join us. If you've got additional questions about Judges, you can reach out to Jared or I. On Facebook, we've got a small, quiet group where we deal with some of the more technical details in the text that we can't effectively cover in the videos. But right now, we're going to ask Jared, if he would, to dismiss us in prayer from this study. And thanks again, everybody.
Lord our God, help us as we go about our lives to serve you and not ourselves, to not see what is right in our own eyes and to take it, but to submit our will to you. That we act as you would act, to choose as you would choose, and to act even in our lives as though we were crucifying ourselves so that you might live through us. As we go about our day today, help us keep you in the forefront of our minds. Help us to seek you, to serve you, and to serve others through you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.